Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Are hotels in downtown Los Angeles getting taxpayer money for free? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCAW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. At a time of cutbacks in police and fire and other public services, the mayor and the city council are giving some $640 million in tax revenue to the developers of three hotels in booming downtown LA. Is it a sound investment or a giveaway? Would the hotels be built anyway? And how come hotels in the rest of the city don't get the same deal? Also tonight, the Lakers' season is over after the second round of the playoffs. What's next? Later on, what are the Republicans waiting for? First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. A crowd of prominent Republicans is supposedly thirsting to run against President Obama next year, but they have waited a long time to make that final commitment. Now Newt Gingrich says he'll take the plunge. Later on, we'll ask, are others finally ready to dive in? First, the bribery scandal at Los Angeles City Hall. The LA Times reports that two building inspectors have been arrested and that a federal grand jury has issued subpoenas seeking personnel records of at least 11 current and former employees. David Zonheiser co-wrote the story. David, it's always good to have you back on our program.
Happy to be here.
One of these people who was arrested has, in fact, pled guilty. The other one is doing a lot of talking.
Well, I don't know how much he's talking, but his attorney talked to us and essentially said that that he is also thinking of entering a guilty plea, although he hadn't made a final decision, at least as of last Friday. More troubling for the city is the fact that the federal grand jury seems to be looking well beyond those initial two figures. I spoke to the city attorney's office last week, and they had indicated that early on there was sort of a hope that it was only really going to deal with two or maybe a couple more beyond that. But with the arrival of the subpoena asking about at least 11 current and former employees, it looks like it's getting bigger.
There was an FBI sting involving an undercover agent posing as a contractor. What was shown by that?
Well, there were a series of recorded conversations in which, in fact, there were photographs taken of an inspector actually being handed cash money. And so that was a problem for that particular defendant. It also recorded one of the inspectors saying he was talking about a bribe. This is according to an affidavit filed in federal court. He was talking about how a bribe would be typically $2,000, but because the address they were talking about was outside of his area, he would need to pay a tribute to another building inspector, and therefore the bribe would be $2,500.
So when the FBI says that this is systemic, there's some reason for saying it. The mayor, however, denies that.
Well, the mayor's office actually hasn't weighed in directly. The head of the Department of Building and Safety said that he did not think that it was systemic, but that he did think, like the city attorney's office, that this was going beyond two individuals. In the case of the FBI, what they did was they had one of their agents filed an affidavit in which they have an undercover informant. And that informant, that confidential informant essentially said that he or she, we don't know for sure because it is confidential, had paid as many as 40 bribes over a certain period of time. And it wasn't limited to just cash in exchange for building approvals, but also labor and I think construction materials, which certainly makes it sound systemic. And that confidential informant actually did use the word systemic to describe the problem.
Okay. The Department of Building and Safety under a cloud. You, David Zonheiser, also wrote a Times story about tax breaks for massive hotels in downtown Los Angeles, which is booming. You said the JW Marriott, which opened last year, is reportedly doing well enough to produce some much-needed tax revenue for the city, which, of course, is cash-strapped. But the Anschutz Entertainment Group, AEG, will be able to keep some $270 million in taxes through the year 2035. And combined with two other such deals, the city could end up giving away $640 million in the next 30 years. David, explain to us how that works.
Well, what's been happening is this. Both Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and the city council have been trying to revitalize downtown for several years now. And they also want to goose business at the convention at the convention center, which has high debt payments and not as many conventions as they think would actually make the city thrive. So to address both of those problems, they basically have offered deals to hotel developers that allow them to keep a portion of the tax revenue that their projects would normally create and would therefore flow into the city's budget. And so the first was Anschutz Entertainment Group, AEG, with its hotel tower at LA Live. The next one that was approved was for the Grand Avenue project, which is near the Museum of Contemporary Art, but is currently stalled and has not been built. And in March, there was a third, which was the Wilshire Grand Hotel, which would be a total reconstruction. It would be like a 45-story hotel and a 65-story office tower at the corner of 7th and Figueroa. So all these hotel deals have sort of led to this pivotal policy question, which is how many more hotels should get these subsidies, and when is it that downtown is truly revitalized? And I think that's something you're going to be hearing more debate about in the future, partly because at least one hotel developer said recently that he, too, is looking at the possibility of seeking some kind of city financial help with a project that would be on Olympic Boulevard directly across from LA Live.
Now, there are members of the city council, or at least one member of the city council, who has questioned this practice, and that's Bill Rosendahl out on the west side.
Yes, and one of the reasons why he's questioning it is, well, partly is because he's getting some heat, according to him, from some of the hotel owners on Century Boulevard, which is near LAX, and he said that the hotels in his district are starting to say, well, wait a minute, you know, how are we to compete with these new large projects that come online? You know, they get these, they get financial help that we simply don't get. And he's trying to balance those complaints against sort of this citywide push to keep trying to help out the convention center.
So is the argument, particularly with the JW Marriott and the Ritz-Carlton downtown, that huge building that they share, is the argument that the building never would have been built if they hadn't been guaranteed the tax subsidies?
That is exactly the argument that has been made. Basically, I spoke to one high-level official who said he doesn't consider it a subsidy. He considers it found money because he said if the financial help wasn't provided, there'd be no tax revenue at all, and so the city wouldn't even get a fraction. Is the thinking.
So it found money for the city.
Yeah.
Again, David Zanheiser is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Again, the mayor and the city council approved these subsidies after analysis, and the analysis came from the PKF consulting firm, and it calls them not subsidies but incentives, and says they are common where they will stimulate new business. Bruce Balton is the senior vice president of that firm. And Bruce Balton, thank you very much for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, what sounds, I think, to a lot of taxpayers like a giveaway.
Well, it is really exactly as you just said. It is, I said it's an incentive. You could also call it an investment. But the issue is that the those tax revenues that are being generated by the JW Marriott, for example, never would exist if the hotel weren't built. And if the hotel couldn't be built without some financial investment by the city, then basically you would never have those revenues. So the tax revenue, there are tax revenues being rebated to the hotel, but they are actually new revenues to the city that would not exist if the hotel weren't built.
How do you determine that the hotel would not have been built had it not been for this guarantee that the tax money could go back to the developer?
Well, in each case, whether it be the Wilshire Grand Hotel or the Grand Avenue or the Marriott Hotel, we're a consulting firm that specializes in the hotel industry, and we were retained actually by the CLA's office to do an analysis for the city council as to the market demand for the hotel, the revenues that would be generated by the hotel, the cost of developing the hotel, and we were asked in each case two questions. Is the revenue that the hotel generates from which rebates would be provided net new revenues to the city? In other words, is it revenues that would not exist were it not for the hotel? And secondarily, does the hotel really require this kind of investment to be economically feasible? And so we've been asked to look at that, what that amount is in each case, and then based upon that, the city then goes back and negotiates with the developer to provide some level of financial assistance. And I think in each case, it's been less than was actually the actual gap that existed, but it still was an investment by the city in terms of a rebate of tax revenues.
So how do you answer that second question? Does the hotel really require it? It seems to me it's sort of hypothetical.
No, it's not hypothetical. I mean, it's analytical. But this kind of analysis is done all the time. That's what we do as a firm is economic feasibility studies and market demand studies. So we can look at what the demand is for the hotel. We also get a development cost budget from the developer. We review the development cost budget in light of the cost of development of similar hotels around the country that actually have occurred, and therefore can come to some kind of a conclusion as to whether or not there actually is a gap.
Well, now, in David Zonheiser's piece, he quotes the owner of the Westin Bonaventure, which is not that far down the street, and he says that it's not appropriate that the and particularly he's talking about the Wilshire Grand, I think, more than he is the JW Marriott. But in any case, he says that it's not necessary, not appropriate, and that all the citizens of Los Angeles are going to have to pay for this.
And that's, again, that's not the case. The Wilshire Grand Hotel, as it exists, basically is a hotel that has had its economic life. It's losing money at this point and really cannot continue to operate as a hotel. And the new hotel that's being recommended is, frankly, a four-star hotel that would benefit the city in terms of the quality of facilities. It would benefit the convention center in terms of the type of amenity for the convention center. Yet it could not afford to be built if in fact, there weren't some investment from the city.
Again, Bruce Balton is Senior Vice President with the PKF Consulting Organization, a hospitality consulting firm. D.J. Waldie was the Deputy City Manager for the city of Linwood until he retired last year, but he's one of the best-known, most respected writers about Southern California. And on his blog for the KCET website, there is a picture of the rooftop swimming pool on the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, which again shares that building with the JW Marriott at LA Live. The caption is, "You are paying for this." Don Waldie, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Warren.
The thrust of your writing about this is that it's a ripoff.
Well, Warren, every city engages in redevelopment activity, and small cities do it in a small way, and big cities do it in a very large way. The issue is, what overall benefit does it bring to the community? What dollars does it bring to the city budget, to the city coffers? And what are the real and hidden costs of the redevelopment project? Serious questions have been raised about redevelopment in recent weeks, based upon Governor Brown's assertion that we should do away with redevelopment agencies entirely. And both he and the state legislative analyst's office have made the claim that redevelopment, broadly speaking, doesn't do much good. It doesn't generate new wealth for the state of California. It doesn't generate necessarily the kinds of promised jobs and benefits that have typically gone with the economic analysis that follows redevelopment agency actions.
On the other hand, in the L.A. Live area, you certainly have a lot of action, and a lot of people are apparently renting rooms at these hotels.
Well, you know, I have a number of questions to ask about the Ritz-Carlton JW Marriott project. This is a tower that's attached to AEG's LA Live, attached to AEG's Staples Center, soon to be attached, if all goes well, to AEG's Farmers Field. It does raise some questions about the imperial reach of AEG's economic footprint downtown, and I begin to wonder, are all these deals, if you add all of the real and hidden costs together, are they really benefiting every resident of the city of Los Angeles? There's a lot of money that flows from their pockets into taxes, and those tax dollars end up in the hands of the developer and the property owner.
Again, it's important, I think, that the hotel itself doesn't develop the building, and it's AEG in this case, not JW Marriott or Ritz-Carlton, that's getting the tax break. Is that right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Bruce Balton, back to you. Can you address that issue?
Yes. Well, AEG is a partial owner of the hotel, and it's managed by Marriott and the Marriott Corporation under the Marriott, JW Marriott, and Ritz-Carlton flags. But the truth of the matter is, in this case, it's been proven to be successful. Yes, every redevelopment project is not the right project, nor is everyone a good project necessarily. But in this case, downtown Los Angeles really was has a need for a headquarters hotel at the convention center. The convention center was not performing as well as it could in competition with other cities such as San Diego, Anaheim, and San Francisco. And one of the big missing factors was a headquarters hotel. And the fact of the matter is this hotel did need some financial investment from the city to be done, and that's proven to be successful. Last year, which is the first year of operation of the hotel, hotel supply went up 16%, hotel demand went up 24%, which is really, if you think about it, spectacular in as bad an economy as occurred in 2010. So this hotel, basically, all the revenues that were generated by the hotel were net new revenues to the city, and the other hotels downtown did benefit, and they have continued to benefit this year.
So, Don Waldy, how do you respond to that?
Well, these are all true as far as one goes, but part of what we have to ask is this simply shifted development, shifted economic growth? Would other parts of Los Angeles have had comparable economic development without the transfer of tax funding, tax funds to developers somewhere else in Los Angeles? Where it's certainly true that an empty lot next to Staples Center is not generating revenue for the city of Los Angeles, but a hotel development somewhere else in the city of Los Angeles, privately funded and not needing a sales tax or property tax or bed tax subsidy, could have been built and generated revenue for the city, more revenue for the city. It's in some ways, the argument is made that redevelopment acts as a zero-sum game, that what you build downtown is what you didn't build in Century City or in some other part of Los Angeles.
And Bruce Bolton, isn't it true also that when you make your analysis, you get the numbers for the cost of development and so on from the developer?
Right, but we do review them for reasonableness as compared with other hotels that actually have been developed around the country. And in answer to Don's previous statement, this is not a zero-sum game because, in truth, if you look historically, Los Angeles has had a very limited amount of hotel development over the last 20 years. It's a very expensive city to develop in. It's hard to find land to develop on that is close to demand drivers. So, in fact, Los Angeles has been is constantly undersupplied with hotel rooms because of the cost of development.
Let me go back to David Zonheiser with the Los Angeles Times. A moment ago, Bruce Bolton said that the Wilshire Grand had run its course, its lifetime was over, and that's why a new kind of subsidy would be needed there. Have you talked to anybody about that?
Well, the developers of that property said absolutely, it's done. That if they said if they did not get financial help, they would outright close, and that of course is something that's disputed by Peter's End of the Bonaventure, which is just a couple blocks away from the Wilshire Grand. I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind is there was mention of AEG earlier. You know, one of the reasons that puts this on the front burner is AEG has been talking up the football stadium, and what they are saying is, hey, if this football stadium happens, there's going to be four or five more hotels that are going to be developed. And they sometimes talk in terms of, you know, thousands of rooms. And so the question is, how many more hotels are going to be wanting what the last hotel got? Is it 1,000 more rooms, you know, 4,000 more rooms, 5,000 more rooms? This is something that I think they're going to start talking about at City Hall because I think there's a desire to turn off the spigot at some point.
In the meantime, Don Waldy, you're saying in your piece on the KCET website that this is just the way the city does business.
Precisely the case. The city of Los Angeles has retooled the old growth machine that turned empty dirt into tract houses from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, has retooled that machine into a mechanism for redevelopment agency-funded expansion of commercial properties. Redevelopment used to be conceived of as a way of making living neighborhoods out of dying ones, and Los Angeles and many other cities in California have turned redevelopment into a mechanism for economic development. It's purely a means for benefiting the participants in the growth machine that we know so well in the city of Los Angeles.
All right. A lot of ways of looking at this. Don Waldy, writer, commentator on Los Angeles, currently blogging for KCET, formerly the deputy city manager of the city of Lakewood. Bruce Bolton with PKF Consulting. David Zonheiser with the Los Angeles Times. Thank you all very much for being on our program today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way L.A. or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Roman, I'll be back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. The three-peat is a dream of the past, and the most successful coach in NBA history said he would retire long before yesterday's four-day sweep by the Dallas Mavericks was finally over. Todd Boyd is a professor of critical studies at USC's School of Cinema and Television. One of his many books is Basketball Jones, America Above the Rim. Todd Boyd, good to have you back on our program.
Always good being on your show, Warren.
Lakers were kind of below the rim for four games there with the Mavericks.
Just a bit. They didn't look very good, and their recent run of success ended with a bang, certainly.
So
not the bang people wanted.
It was not, and maybe more of a whimper. What happened, in your opinion?
Well, I think, first of all, when you look at the fact that as a successful team, certainly since 2008, the Lakers have been to three finals, and what that means is you're playing an additional number of games after the regular season every year. So I think the number is like 77 or 78 games the Lakers have played in addition to their 82 regular season games combined since 2008. So that's basically the equivalent of another entire season. So in one sense, I think it's just the physical demands of being successful means you play a lot more games, and eventually it catches up with you. I think also, though, to be successful in the NBA, it requires talent, of course, and the Lakers certainly have no shortage of talent, but it also requires guys, you know, embracing a team concept, a certain mentality, you know, certain approach to the game. It's mental in many ways as much as it is physical, and I think over time, the mental challenges and demands simply caught up with the Lakers. Phil Jackson alluded to this in his press conference yesterday, that trying to three-peat is very difficult, and there's a reason that this hasn't happened very often. I mean, the Chicago Bulls did it with Phil Jackson, and the Lakers, of course, did it with Phil Jackson again, you know, earlier this decade, but it's not easy. There's a reason that people are not able to do it, and I think the physical and mental demands of trying to win a championship year after year took its toll and eventually caught up to the Lakers, and Dallas embarrassed them and ended their season.
So what next, given the fact that the Lakers have an enormous payroll to pay, and that makes it very difficult to make trades? And you tell me more. You're the expert on this. How are they going to put it back together?
Well, I think Laker fans need to prepare for some lean years to come. I mean, it's, again, not a given that you're going to win in the NBA. The Lakers owner, Jerry Buss, is someone who's been willing to spend a lot of money to put, you know, great players on the floor. Those players have gotten older. Some of them still have contracts that, you know, put the financial burden on the Lakers in such a way that it's going to be difficult to trade these players. Kobe Bryant, for instance, who I don't think anyone would ever imagine being traded, but he's the only player in the NBA who has a no-trade clause, which means any trade that would happen regarding him would be something he would have to approve. That's not going to happen. But my point is, when you look at some of their other players, Ron Artest, for instance, Pau Gasol, the contract numbers that are attached to these players is such that it would be really difficult to make a lot of trades, and that is what would be needed to improve the team. So I think with the success the Lakers have had, they are now in a position where financially, it's going to be difficult to make moves, and there's the possibility of a lockout this summer once the season is over, and people are suggesting that the financial restraints on all teams in the NBA are going to be very different going forward, and so this doesn't bode well either. You know, the Lakers are very good. They've been very good for a long time. You could argue since 1980 that the Lakers have been the most successful franchise in the NBA. You don't even have to argue that. The statistics bear it out. If you talk about, you know, the number of championships won. But it's not a given that you're going to go to the finals every year. It's not a given that you're going to win a title. It's not a given that you're going to even be competitive in the NBA. Laker fans, I think, are accustomed to this team performing at a high level. But if you look at the league, you look at the other teams, you will find that, you know, teams go through stretches where they don't do so well. And I think with Kobe Bryant at the age he's at, the financial issues, the looming lockout, and the rest of the league has gotten better. You know, you look at Miami, Chicago, some of these younger teams like Memphis and Oklahoma City, you know, teams have gotten better. It's a new day. This happens, okay. And I think people need to be aware that it might be a while before the Lakers are competitive again.
One phrase answer. Who's going to win this year?
Miami.
Todd Boyd, the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture and Professor of Critical Studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
You can join our conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, what are the Republicans waiting for on Which Way LA? Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. Even Republicans with double-digit support in the polls have been slow to get into the race for the presidential nomination. Today, the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich pre-announced that he will formally announce his candidacy on Wednesday. Chris Ciliza covers the White House for The Washington Post, and he blogs at The Fix. Chris, it's always good to have you on our program.
Warren, thank you for having me.
He gets 2 days of news out of this way.
Well, you know, it's a very meta thing that we now go through. Candidates announce that they're planning to announce an exploratory committee to potentially announce that they're running for president. So, I mean, look, all of this is aimed at a pretty basic strategic concept, which is they want to get as many bites at the media apple as possible. So Newt Gingrich gets attention today when he says he's planning on announcing, and then on Wednesday, when we expect him to more formally announce, he'll get more attention, and then on Friday, when he goes and speaks to the Georgia Republican Party convention, he'll get more attention. So this is kind of an attempt to dominate the week. Obviously, external events have some say over that, Warren. You don't always get to pick and choose what else happens in the world, but this is the modern era of announcing for president.
Wednesday, it's going to be Facebook and Twitter and an interview on Fox News.
Yep, and what's fascinating about it is all candidates, I feel, Democrats and Republicans, announce these things via social media, Facebook, Twitter. They put video on YouTube. And yet they, as you pointed out, pre-announce. So you kind of know it's coming. Newt Gingrich's spokesman, Rick Tyler, longtime spokesperson, said, Newt going to be announcing for president on Twitter on Wednesday. He said that where? On Twitter. So, you know, it's a very odd way of going about it. But the broader point, not to lose sight of it, is Newt Gingrich is now, we expect to be formally in the race. This is not an exploratory committee or anything like this. This is a formal announcement of his candidacy. One of the few early and serious presidential candidates to jump both feet into the race.
What other candidates have made formal announcements?
Well, it depends. That depends on what the meaning of formal is. Some of the better known, or at least people who think people think are going to be serious contenders in this race, Warren, people like Mitt Romney, who is regarded as the front runner, the former Massachusetts governor. He ran last time around, came up short. He has formed an exploratory committee that essentially allows him to begin raising money for a presidential bid. He will transition into a full presidential committee sometime in the next couple weeks, by June, I would assume. Would say the same about Tim Pawlenty, a much lesser known figure nationally, the former governor of Minnesota, but someone who's putting together a serious campaign. Also has an exploratory committee. And then we have lesser-known candidates who are given less of a chance of winning. People like Rick Santorum, the former Pennsylvania senator, has an exploratory committee. Herman Cain, who actually got a bit of notoriety at the end of last week after the Fox News Channel debate where many people thought he won it, is in this race and running. So I think within the next month, probably the next 2 weeks, Warren, we're going to have most of the major candidates in this race in one way, shape, or form. And that includes people like John Huntsman, the former U.S. ambassador to China, Mitch Daniels. We'll know one way or another, I think, by the end of this month, the Indiana governor, that is, whether he's running or not running. So I think things will get clearer in the next few weeks, though I've been saying that for the last 3 months. So take it with a grain of salt.
Chris Ciliza with the Washington Post, writing the Fix blog at that paper. Rich Galen is publisher of the online political newsletter Mullings.com. He's also a Republican strategist, and he was communications strategist for Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House of Representatives. Rich, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you. I agree with everything Chris said, including the part that I've been saying the same thing for 2 months. Oh, we'll know in 2 weeks I've been saying that since, I think, the early February.
Well, you worked for Newt Gingrich, and yeah. We've talked about him before on our program, and he's obviously been considering this for a long period of time. Is he big enough to bring all these other guys in at the same time with him to cause them to say, wait a minute, I better get in there or I'll be behind?
I think everybody will get in at about the same time, but not because of Newt, nor in spite of Newt. I think everybody's operating on their own timetable. This is, I mean, if World War II was the first mechanized, totally mechanized war, this is the first totally internet election. And as Chris was pointing out, you know, using Twitter to announce that your boss is going to announce on Twitter is kind of an example of that. But I think everybody decided that they can just wait and save, you know, millions of dollars by not starting this process up in December of last year or in January. But now that we're into the middle of May, just about, I think we'll see everybody sort of say, okay, the time has come. Let's mount up. Let's get everybody on the payroll. Let's open the offices and let's see where this takes us.
Well, how is this a saving of money? Why is it that, as in the past, you don't have the same you don't have the same kind of situation you had in the past, where the idea was to jump in as early as possible? Jimmy Carter invented the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah, but that's because he didn't have to. Let's take Newt as the example. I'm not campaigning for Newt. I just happen to know this because I wrote a column about it, that he has 1.3 million followers on Facebook, and I assume the other major candidates are in about those same sort of ranges. So that means that Newt can reach out to 1.3 million people at 140 characters a shot four times a day, 7 days a week if he wants, and not really spend a dime doing it. That you counter that with what Carter did, and actually Barack Obama did 4 years ago when they were Obama was in Iowa. They had offices up and running in, you know, everywhere from Des Moines to Sioux City, working the people face to face. With the new use of social media, you can effectively accomplish reaching out and touching your supporters and potential supporters at a very, very low price, knowing that you're going to have to spend every dime on TV and organizing for the caucuses and for the primaries.
Rich Galen again, Mullings.com, his political newsletter. Republican strategist once worked for Newt Gingrich. David Yepsen was the go-to guy for years for the national press as the chief political writer for the Des Moines Register. He was there for 34 years. He's now Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. David Yepsen, good to talk with you again.
It's good to be with you.
What's happening? What are Twitter and Facebook doing to the Iowa caucuses?
Well, I think I agree with everything that's been said. It's postponed. It delays somewhat the start. There are a lot of reasons why this race is off to a slow start. Money is one. I think a lot of Republicans are trying to figure out how they just who all is in it and how they would play off Obama. There is some frustration among Republicans in Iowa. A group of them are headed out to talk to Chris Christie about running. But this reminds me a little bit of what we saw in 1992 and 1988, a field of Democrats that a lot of people weren't happy with, and you heard things like Seven Dwarfs and descriptions like that. And you know, I think it's a little early to be dismissing the field that way. A lot of Iowa caucus goers in both parties like to wait a long time. They like to see the candidates up close. And you can't do some of that stuff on Twitter and online. And so I imagine, you know, at some point we're going to see a pretty traditional Iowa caucus campaign, and somebody's going to start winning elections and winning primaries and winning caucuses, and they're going to develop some momentum. Don't forget that in 1980 in Iowa, there was this grade B movie actor. Everybody thought he was too old. Two-thirds of Iowa Republican caucus voters voted against Ronald Reagan. And today we view him as a political icon. So I think some of this rap on the Republican field will change as soon as somebody starts winning some primaries and caucuses.
As a Californian, I have to point out that grade B movie actor had been the governor of the biggest state in the union prior to 1980. That did give him some credibility beyond his acting experience.
Well, that's true, but I don't dismiss Mitt Romney or Tim Pawlenty as lacking some heft here. Both of these men won elections in states that are generally considered to be pretty Democratic. So I just feel warned that a lot of people are being very dismissive of this Republican field, and they really shouldn't be. I think Barack Obama is going to be very vulnerable in November. He's riding a little bit of a bump now, but that's ephemeral. It won't last more than a couple months, if that. People are still unhappy with the economy. So the Republican nomination is a prize worth having, and I think there are people in this race who have the ability to win in November.
Vin Weber is a former Republican congressman from Minnesota. He's now co-chair of Tim Pawlenty's Political Action Committee. Vin Weber, good to have you on our program.
Great to be with you.
I have to say that one of the phrases, memorable phrases of this year's campaign is when the one Republican strategist referred to last week's debate in South Carolina as the bar scene from Star Wars, but your guy was there.
Well, I was my friend Scott Reed, and I really didn't like that comment. I watched the debate. I understand that a lot of the most prominent candidates weren't there. Governor Romney wasn't there. My friend Newt Gingrich wasn't there. Mike Huckabee, who may or may not run, wasn't there. But I watched the debate. There were some fairly serious people up there, and to demean them that way I thought was just wrong. I'm advising plenty. I want him to do the best, and I would have loved to have him up against Romney. But I watched the rest of those candidates up there who are admittedly long shots. They didn't say anything embarrassing to me. They seemed pretty smart. You know, we had a guy who was a couple-term governor of New Mexico. Rick Santorum was the
Johnson is the former governor of New Mexico.
New Mexico. Rick Santorum was the number three Republican in the United States Senate before he got beat. You know, Ron Paul has run for president in the past and was successful in getting a lot of votes and raising a lot of contributions. I don't think these guys are going to win the nomination, but to demean them that way seemed to me to be improper, although I certainly hope in the next debate you get a broader field.
Let me go back to Chris Saliza with the Washington Post and the Fix blog. You mentioned a guy named Kane as having really stood out in
right.
that debate. Who's Kane?
Herman Kane is, let me first say I agree with Vin's assessment there of his guy and Pawlenty being on stage. Tim Pawlenty is a guy who, outside of the five of us on this interview, lots of people don't know who he is. To put him in front of lots and lots, tens, hundreds of thousands of Fox News Channel viewers is never a bad thing, and I thought he performed quite well. I would actually say that he won the debate given the constraints he had as the one guy on that stage who is seen as someone who could actually win the nomination. But to your point, Warren, in the focus group that Frank Luntz, a Republican pollster, held afterward, the people who watched the debate were overwhelmingly praiseworthy of Herman Cain. This is an African-American guy, was the CEO of a company named Godfather's Pizza, has run for office before, though never for president, has run for the Senate from Georgia. And this is somebody who, honestly, if you talk to people in the run-up to this debate, Republicans who have seen, been paying attention, they would have said, look, you know, my guess is Herman Cain probably winds up winning the debate. He's a businessman. He has no electoral record. He's never been in elected office. Those are three very good things if you are a Republican running in a Republican primary race like this one where voters are distrustful of politicians. And he's quite an able speaker. He speaks succinctly, very common sense. So he got a little bit of a bump, clearly, out of it. Now, again, as I said at the beginning, I return to it. I think ultimately Herman Cain financially and organizationally is not going to be able to capitalize on that, though I do think he could be a factor in Iowa. I think he could be appealing to social conservatives. I think his stump style is appealing in a state like that. He's going to spend a lot of time in that state.
And he doesn't have any political baggage, never having run for anything before. Rich Galen, back to you. You formerly worked for Newt Gingrich. He's got a lot of political baggage.
Well, you know, the perfect candidate comes along about every 2011 years. So no matter who you talk about, there's always some downside. You know, Ronald Reagan, to go back to what David was talking about earlier, was he was divorced. You couldn't have a divorced man as president. John Kennedy was a Catholic. These things, you know, they're sort of a big deal until they're not a big deal anymore. And I think when the country is faced with the kinds of internal and external issues that America is right now, everything from gasoline prices at the corner pump to what China's doing in terms of manipulating their currency and their economy, I suspect what people will be looking for are candidates who can enunciate a clear vision for what they want America to be and a clear path to how they expect to help America get there. And the other stuff will fall by the wayside.
Does Gingrich, though, in particular, have a problem? You mentioned Reagan's divorce. Gingrich has been married three times, and at one point divorced his wife when, in fact, she had cancer. Is that going to rise up and be used as the campaign?
Yeah.
No question.
Did. Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, she wasn't on her deathbed. She's still alive, as far as I know. But the bad news is that'll come up. The good news is people have been talking about. Mother Jones has been writing about that every 3 months, you know, for the last 20 years. So it's not exactly, new news to almost anybody.
We need to get more of the potential candidates than we have so far. David Yepsen, what are some of the bigger names that we haven't heard so far? One of them, of course, is Haley Barbour, who's dropped out.
Right, and I think there were a lot of Republicans looking to him as possibly a knight on a shining horse. The party out of power always has a problem in message-wise, defining who we are, what do we stand for, and there's always the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence.
Vin Weber, the one member of our panel who does, in fact, have a candidate this time, and that's Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota. Back to the debate, which you watched, even though the Speaker of the House didn't. What about Herman Cain or somebody like that coming out of the blue under these circumstances, or relatively out of the blue? Cain has been around for a while. He was publicized, I think, as long ago as 1998 in a public forum. But is there a possibility of that happening? And might Herman Cain, an African-American successful businessman, be the guy?
Well, I know Herman Cain a bit. I haven't kept up with him in recent years, but even though he's not held office, he's been around politics a long time. He was involved in supporting conservative politics in the 1990s, and I got to know him somewhat then. He's smart. He's articulate. He's accomplished things. Also was the chairman of the Kansas City Federal Reserve at one point. And I think that he's a serious person who ought to be treated seriously. That doesn't mean he's likely to win the Republican nomination. I do think at the end of the day, in this country, we have to check a certain box in terms of basic qualifications. And one of those qualifications is experience in government. Herman tried very well in the debate to sort of put that down and say, well, if you want experience in government, that's what you got. How do you like it so far? But I think that the American people are not going to pick somebody who doesn't have any experience in government. But he adds to the debate. He's a good guy and quite articulate.
What about the remark by Ron Paul, who, among other things, said heroin ought to be legalized? But he also said, and got a lot of applause when he said it, that the killing of Osama bin Laden now means this is a good time to bring the troops home from Afghanistan. Is that going to be a serious issue for Republicans?
I think that was a very important comment in that debate. I think that we are on the verge for the first time in a long time of having a serious discussion about national security policy in the Republican Party. Republicans have pretty much lined up together on national security policy, at least since Ronald Reagan. We're the party of a strong national defense and a willingness to intervene on behalf of American interests, and that was about it. You mentioned Haley Barbour a few minutes ago, our friend who decided not to run. Had Haley run, we would already have seen that issue put further forward because he was talking about pulling out of Afghanistan and cutting the defense budget. So there's a possibility for the first time, I think, in a long time of a real debate over national security policy taking place within the Republican Party.
David Yepsen, back to you now with the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. Cutting the defense budget, we've talked a lot about that on our program and how difficult that is to do in any really thoroughgoing way because there's a subcontractor in virtually every congressional district for a lot of projects, which even the leaders of the Pentagon don't think we need anymore. How serious do you think Republicans can get about that?
Well, I think they can get very serious, and I think that I think the size of the nation's deficits and the debt problem we have really changes some of this debate. I mean, go back to earlier what I said earlier. I mean, the Republican Party is redefining itself and what it stands for on a lot of things, and defense is certainly one of them. But you take a state like Iowa,
where this thing starts, I mean, that has some of the lowest per capita levels of defense spending of any state in the country. So I think you even have candidates who go out there and talk about reducing ethanol support, and, you know, the lightning doesn't strike them. A lot of Republicans agree with that. Ron Paul was sort of hooted in his party 4 years ago when he suggested the country shouldn't be involved in all these wars. I think, you know, people may have caught up with him. He has some support for that point of view. There is a libertarian streak inside the Republican Party. So, yes, the short answer, Warren, is I do think the country and the Republican Party can have a serious debate about reducing military spending.
Rich Galen, the Democrats have been castigated by Republicans since the McGovern campaign in 1972 when he was critical of the war effort. Do you think the Republicans want to give that up and let the Democrats be the party of strong national defense?
Well, I don't think there's any question that Republicans will remain the party of strong national defense. To Yepsen's point, though, and I agree with him, one of the things that Leon Panetta, who has been nominated to be defense secretary, brings to the table is here is a man who was a member of the U.S. House, a highly respected member of the House, was in the White House as chief of staff and as CIA director, knows that whole thing. So if anybody can go up to the Hill and talk the language that members understand in terms of what needs to be cut, what needs to be saved, how best to arrive at that, I think Panetta may be a real ace in the hole for President Obama. But to your point, it's one thing to say we need to have, you know, to use the old saw, $130 toilets. It's something else to say we can't cut beyond the levels necessary to make sure that America's interests are protected.
David Yepsen, is the real issue going to be jobs and the economy?
Yes. Even among social conservatives, it's interesting. A lot of people talk about the influence of the religious conservatives, particularly in the Iowa process, and that's true, but it's also true in other states. But if you look at the issues that social conservatives care most about, they're jobs and the economy. They're not that much different than Americans as a whole. So, and I think we're seeing this start to take a toll on Obama. He's enjoying this uptick now, but those same polls show that the same people are having trouble with his handling of the economy. The forecast for unemployment on Election Day 2012 that I saw was for 7.7% unemployment, which is what it was when Jimmy Carter beat Gerald Ford. We are creating jobs, but they're not fast enough to make a dent in this. And you know, the American people do not feel good about the economy. Forget about the markets and these other unemployment metrics. The issue in politics is how do people feel about this? And I don't think Americans are feeling a whole lot better. And therein lies, I think, the Republican opportunity to come in with someone who can be seen as a credible president, someone who is competent on defense questions and who has some experience, and say, I am an alternative to what you have now. And that could break very late. I mean, the Reagan phenomenon in 1980 against Jimmy Carter didn't break until relatively late in that campaign. So we can pick away and people can talk about, you know, the bar scenes in Star Wars, but I think that's way too dismissive of the opportunity that Republicans have here.
Do you think, David Yepsen, that it would be a mistake for the Republicans at this point to emphasize the social issues as opposed to the economic?
Well, I do, because it will alienate centrists. It alienates moderate women. I mean, we saw that happen in a race for governor here in Illinois. I mean, there's a huge Republican sweep going on, but it didn't happen in Illinois. And if you look at it, there were two reasons why. Number one, moderate women who voted for the Republican for the U.S. Senate, but then they did not vote for the Republican running for governor because he was seen as too far to the right. So Republicans, you know, they have to watch their right-hand flank, just like Democrats have to watch their left flank. And the other factor that was involved in this race, and I think it works against Republicans, is what do Latino voters do? Republicans who go out and whip up all this nativist support, bashing immigrants, are driving Latinos into the Democratic Party. And Republicans did that 150 years ago to the Irish in this country. And I think they're doing it again with Latino Americans. So that's something that I think we need to keep an eye on as this race unfolds. Can Republicans be acceptable? Can a Republican candidate be acceptable to social conservatives, but yet move to the center? Can it be acceptable to Latino voters without alienating the far right? That's the juggling act that the successful Republican nominee is going to have to do.
Vin Weber, back to you. Your guy is Tom Pawlenty, your co-chair of the Political Action Committee. How is he dealing with that that question of social issues on the one hand? And then the other question of what David Yepsen just referred to as nativism and the focus on immigration.
First of all, he's got a solid record on the right on social issues. He's a member of an evangelical church in Minnesota that is presided over by the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. And he has a good appeal to social conservatives. He is never a guy that has worn it on his sleeve. It has never been in the forefront of his campaigns for governor of Minnesota, or necessarily in the forefront of a campaign for the presidency. But he's perfectly comfortable with those issues and acceptable to those folks. But I think he understands that this is essentially an economic campaign. I would add only one thing to David Yepsen's analysis. We use unemployment as kind of a shorthand for economic problems. There's a lot of evidence that the real issue that drives people's voting economically is incomes. And unfortunately, incomes are stagnant or relative to inflation declining right now, and that's probably a worse problem for this administration than unemployment. Finally, the immigration issue, David Yepsen is exactly right. It's a problem for our party. It's a problem for all the candidates. Because at the grassroots level, particularly in the early caucus states, particularly in David Yepsen's old state of Iowa, people that go to those caucuses want a strong stand against immigration, and ultimately Republicans have a difficult time with that issue because it does run the risk of doing exactly what he suggested, which is alienating the fastest-growing demographic in our country, which is Hispanic voters.
That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Francis Anderton, Gary Scott, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. And you can join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.